Coming up on Boston Public Radio, the governor joins us.
Excuse me, Jim. I got this.
Okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the governor. I'll be coming up soon with Marjorie and Jim, and we'll be talking about issues facing the Commonwealth, facing the country, and facing you.
God, that was spectacular, Governor. Thank you very much. After that, the Boston Globe's Alex Beam on our enduring fascination with John Fitzgerald Kennedy, close to the 50th anniversary of his death. Continuing in our aging series, we'll tell you something fascinating. It's called the longevity dividend. Then Karen Miller on reverse migration, out of the burbs and back to the cities. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
I am Marjorie Egan. He is Jim Browdy. You've just been listening to a live press conference. Barack Obama, the President of the United States, addressing the messes and snafus and his fixes to the health care problem. And we have Governor Deval Patrick here. We're going to talk to him in just a second about his reaction to what the President had to say.
And part of what he had to say is, if you just tuned in, was he talked about enrollment numbers, including close to 400,000 people who access health care through Medicaid in terms of the enrollees. And he also addressed the issue that people have been talking about quite a bit, the commitment he made that people could keep their own health plans. And he said through 2014, if you chose to do so, even if it did not meet the minimum threshold of coverage of the Affordable Care Act, you would be entitled to do that should you choose to do so. Here to give his reaction to this and virtually everything else, as he does once a month, would be the governor of the Commonwealth, Deval Patrick. Pleasure to see you, Governor.
Nice to see you both. Nice to see you both. And my first reaction is, I can't believe the president cut into my time with you.
It's outrageous.
It's
really
ridiculous.
He should have checked with you.
I know.
What was your reaction?
Well, I get it. What he's proposed, I guess, is what he's ordered is a is the option for insurers to continue old policies that don't meet the minimum standards of the ACA for a period of time, as long as people, those insurers are in, inform their customers that those existing policies are inadequate and what is lacking, and that they have options to get a better policy under the marketplace. You know, okay, if that's a temporary patch, maybe that's helpful. But the basic question of how we, through a market-based solution, which is what this is, provide adequate insurance and the security of adequate insurance to everybody still remains, which means they got to get the systems right so people can get in.
By the way, we got thrown off a little bit here. The governor is here to take your questions and ours for the hour. The number to get to him directly is 877-301-8970. You don't seem terribly happy about this decision. I mean, many people think that Bill Clinton started the ball rolling with his statement the other day. There's a vote tomorrow on a Republican proposal to do essentially the same thing this guy Upton from Michigan that has apparently some Democratic support. This was done as a political necessity, not as necessarily great health care policy, correct?
Well, you know, there's so much about health care which has been kind of soaked in politics for a long time in this country. It's not just with the ACA and the rollout of it. I think what you're seeing in my face, and maybe those of you listening.
Oh, by the way, they can see you too at WGBHnews.org. My apologies.
I think your head is in the way. isn't the camera?
It's
right
always
above
in the way. Yes, it is. Thank you,
well,
Governor. Thank
well,
you for that. I appreciate it.
Marjorie, right?
Okay, fine.
You have the best line, if we would divert for just 1 second, about Jim Browdy. Do you remember what you've always said?
Let's save it for a year from now.
Okay, fine. Go ahead.
Anyway, I was just going to say that the ACA in particular is in this pathetic kind of dynamic in Washington, where you have the proponents, for the people who believe that folks should not have health care, and that it shouldn't be delivered in a market-based solution like this. Most of them hard right Republicans, who have been looking to undermine this from the beginning and are sitting around rooting for the problems of implementation, as if they are sorry that it isn't being smoothly implemented when they didn't want it implemented in the first place. And then you have on the other side what I perceive to be, and I say this respectfully, but folks in the Obama administration who are so understandably conscious about that larger dynamic that they aren't surfacing, I think, all of the issues that come with a big, complex rollout or a rollout of a big, complex initiative like this in time enough not just to communicate with a larger public but to create an atmosphere to fix them. So you've got this weird kind of, you know, yes, there's a problem, but we can't really say anything about it because if we say anything about it, then the people who want it to fail will seize on that. It's just nuts.
Well, you know, there has been some concern locally, and we just got an email about this from Louise Marie Pardon. I forgot my glasses, so I have to put my...
You do have on your movie star shades.
My movie star shades. This is from Louise Marie talking about in Massachusetts, Massachusetts Health Connector, which has traditionally worked pretty well.
Very well, yeah.
It's almost as if it's been infected by the Affordable Care Act virus. She says, Louise Marie, I am one of the 150,000 Massachusetts residents eligible for subsidized health insurance, required to sign up for the new affordable care coverage beginning January 1st. And she, like many other people, trying for weeks, spent endless hours on the website, on the phone, still doesn't have insurance. I am getting scared, she says, I won't have health coverage in January. And I should point out, the Herald reported earlier this week that there were these weird things that people with hyphenated names couldn't get on the system, and people at the end of signing up had to claim that they were in jail or in a mental facility with mental health problems to sign up. Now, supposedly those have been fixed, but it is
There's another one like that. It's, you know, I didn't realize this, but some Social Security numbers aren't numbers. They have letters in them.
I didn't know that.
I didn't either, but apparently the system also wasn't set up to accept letters in a Social Security number. So that, I mean, it's a fix, but this is actually quite a lot. Marjorie, I'm sorry, you didn't finish your question.
That's okay. Well, she is understandably concerned, scared, as she says, that it's now November 14th.
Yeah.
She's afraid in six weeks.
What's her name?
I'll give you the email before you go. Her first name is Louise Marie.
So Louise Marie?
Yes, that's her email. She just emailed.
To Louise Marie and others, individuals who are dealing with what is basically a slow website right now, don't be afraid. Nobody's going to get thrown off and be uninsured. First of all, January 1 is not the deadline here. It's March. It's the end of March. It's a relatively small number of people. Frankly, we're trying to figure out whether it's possible just to move everybody who's already on Commonwealth Care into Connector Care, which is the ACA equivalent, basically, that we've designed. Nobody's going to be left out. You can call and get signed up that way rather than wait for the website to be as smooth as we'd like. And we're staffing up in the call center in order to enable that. Just to go beyond the individuals, though, who are eligible for subsidies, if you're a small business, it works pretty well right now, end to end. If you're not
individuals thing,
it's not all individuals. It's the individuals who are eligible for subsidies, because the subsidies are in a variety of forms. Some of them are direct. Some of them are tax related, and you gotta get the right one so that you don't get you don't get dinged at the end of the year, at the end of next year when you file your taxes. But if you're a small business, for example, and you're trying to see what your options are for yourself and your employees, you can get in and get out end to end. It's pretty smooth. If you there's a lot of volume,
right.
So that will slow it down a little bit. But if you're an individual without subsidies, you can also get in end to end. It's pretty straightforward. The subsidies, I say, are the complexity. And we're working that out. It gets a little better every day.
Just one last thing on this. I know that the open enrollment continues to March 31st,
mm-hmm.
but lots of these people that are worried are claiming that they're in a particular situation, whether they're coming from a private insurer or whatever, that their policy is running out at the end of the year.
No, so I totally get it.
They've got six weeks, some of these people.
I totally get it.
Okay.
And, I met only yesterday. My team does constantly, but I met only yesterday with the leadership of the Connector, which is our version of the exchange, as you know, and to get briefed by them, to hear what they saw as the obstacles are, what their deadlines are, and my instruction to them is overcompensate, under promise if you have to, rather than say it's definitely going to be this date and everything's great, because we know how that is. You'll be the first one to say, "Aha!
Right.
It was December 2nd, not December 1st."
Yep.
But don't be shy about saying, I need this additional resource. I need this additional. I need some help. I need a solution that we haven't devised all on our own. Because I do think that there is a. This is back to my problem about my point about the problem I see in the environment in Washington, which is that they don't have in the Obama administration the environment to operate where they can make an honest mistake or say, honestly, I'm not quite sure we have the best solution to this individual glitch or what have you, without people saying, see, I told you, we are so advantaged. I would put it more positively. We are so advantaged here in the Commonwealth that the coalition that invented healthcare was so broad, and that coalition has stuck together to refine it as we've gone along.
Since we got a late start, because the president was speaking, Governor, why don't we take some calls almost right away?
Okay.
Governor Patrick.
Harry is calling from Alston. Harry, you there?
Hi, Harry.
Hi, Governor. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hey, Governor, I'm one of many Alston residents who are really excited about the Mass Pike straightening project you announced last month.
Yeah.
I think it's great. You know, MassDOT is doing so many wonderful things these days with Green Dot and the Fast 14 and the new Healthy Transportation Directive.
Yeah. Thank you.
So the reason I'm calling is that
I feel a butt coming, though, Harry. What's
How about an and an also?
Okay.
So we're also concerned in the neighborhood that this plan needs to be more than about just straightening the turnpike, but
yep.
that it also needs to focus on reconnecting the Alston neighborhoods that were split in half by the turnpike 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And where this is specifically or really timely right now is that there's a $10 million MassDOT maintenance project planned for next year on a Mass Pike overpass bridge on Cambridge Street, which is
in Alston? In Alston, Harry?
In Alston, just okay. a stone's throw from where the pike's going to be straightened out.
Okay.
And this bridge is really messed up. It's terrible for biking. It's terrible for walking. It's not ADA compliant. And none of these projects can be fixed by just a maintenance project.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the neighborhood is hoping is that this bridge can get rolled into the much larger turnpike straightening project so that when it's fixed right.
Are you talking about the one down by the pizzeria?
Absolutely. You've been there.
When you come out, you come up JFK, I guess it is, and you turn right there at the gas station, and then you come over that bridge before you get to the next light?
Yep.
Okay.
That's the one.
I'll look at that.
That would be great.
I'll look at that.
We know that you had a really crucial role in the decision to build the new pedestrian bridge over Storrow Drive next to the Longfellow Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be a wonderful project. And it would just be fantastic to have your support on this project here in Alston so that, you know, this bridge, there's an amazing proposal by Tom Dedarian to build a Boston Strong Memorial Bridge for mm-hmm. pedestrians to cross the turnpike,
mm-hmm.
which I hope you've seen.
I haven't.
There's just tremendous potential to really do something great, but that can't happen if DOT rushes ahead with this maintenance project and then we're stuck with really a substandard bridge for the next 50 years.
So, Harry, on that bridge, if you just hang on, let me get some information. I'm sure there is a public process. It sounds like you would know what that is, but if not, I will make sure you get plugged into that and DOT into your point of view. I'll come back to the straightening out of the turnpike, though, for people who may not know what this is about. If you travel the turnpike going, let's say you're coming into the city, so traveling east, when you're coming up to Alston, the before the Alston tolls, the turnpike makes a big left turn and then a big right turn after the tolls back over by the, I guess it would be, is it BU or Northeastern right there?
BU.
Is it BU?
BU.
So the playing field and the high-rise dorms.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Luxury high-rise dorms.
They're
great.
Pretty nice.
It's beautiful.
Some of the best views in the city.
Yes.
And because of the deal we made to buy the rights of way for the Worcester Line and actually in that same package for South Coast Rail, we now own the land that runs alongside the train tracks, which go straight. And so it would say we're going to do the open road tolling anyway, as you know. We've talked about that on the show before. We're going to straighten out the pike at that point, so it's a straight line. Reconnect the land on the that would be south side of the Pike, Harry, I think, with Alston land that Harvard and others own, which yep. creates opportunity for some marvelous new ways of thinking about the neighborhood and you know where the next expansion opportunities are for Boston, and I fully expect that the neighborhood will be involved in that. And
we hope so. And the best way to describe that project is you'll have about 5,000 new fans a day who won't be stuck in the Mass Pike off ramp, DoubleTree Hotel,
yeah, right.
River Street Bridge intersection,
right.
which is probably one of the worst in the state. And this
it might
really
be it might be one of the worst in the country.
Hey Harry, stay on hold, and our producers will get the number and give it to the governor's office, and obviously you will hear from them. Governor, want to go back to the phones?
Okay, Mike is calling from Palmer. Mike, you there?
Hi, Mike.
Yes, I am.
Sorry to keep you holding.
I have a question for the governor.
Yeah.
That's okay. I have a question for the governor.
Mm-hmm.
If a $1 billion casino was proposed for Richmond, Mass.,
yeah.
would you fight for it or against it? And I really want an answer to that question. And in addition, with three casinos in Massachusetts, everybody would live within a 50-mile radius of a casino. Don't you think the people should have had a vote before the legislature passed the casino law?
We got it, Mike. Thank you for your call.
So, Mike, on your first question, I can't speak for my neighbors in Richmond. You ask about Richmond just so everyone knows because my family and I live in Richmond. I would vote against it personally. The law that was enacted by the legislature in a democratic process provides that local residents get a say in whether they want a facility in their community. So as I say, I can't speak for my neighbors. I would vote against it. In terms of whether everybody should get to vote on the question, like I said, we have a democratic process where the legislature is supposed to take up those kinds of issues on behalf of the rest of us. And there were robust debates over a couple of years time. I think I'm right that there's a referendum on the
Milford is Tuesday.
The referendum coming up. I think there's
a statewide ballot initiative.
Well, I was going to ask you, and Mike, thank you for the call. Just say they are collecting signatures. Mm-hmm. Originally, Martha Coakley, who's got the jurisdiction, ruled that it violated the Constitution.
Oh,
the judge allowed them to collect signatures. Mm-hmm. The SJC will decide if they can go ahead. And if they do go ahead, they could repeal the whole law on the ballot next November
next
when people are voting for governor. And on that note, if I can, and obviously Mike's from Palmer, where there was a vote, I think it went down by 97 votes the same day that by 12% it lost in East Boston. And obviously,
it's actually an interesting – I'm sorry.
Oh, no, go right ahead, Governor.
It's actually an interesting point. You said the margin was 97.
97, I think.
97
Palmer.
Votes.
I think it was, yeah.
I mean, it's – you know, people feel some people have real passion on either side of this question. And I'm not going to speak for the wisdom of a facility in Palmer or in any other particular community, but the vote shows that it wasn't a slam dunk; that there wasn't necessarily a consensus view in that community, and I think that's exactly the kind of thing that the bill was meant to provide for.
And the law you signed would allow for up to three casinos and a sloth parlor. But it seems, Governor, even though I know you're legal counsel and you believe that the Aquinnah tribe on the Martha's Vineyard does not have a right to build what they say will be a modest casino there, we are facing a potential of five casinos, three commercially licensed, two Native American, one in Southeast, one on Martha's Vineyard, and a slots parlor. Does that not worry you? That could be the outcome of this process.
I don't – well, if I thought that was going to be the outcome, I wouldn't sign the bill because I do think that's too much. You can have a parade of horrors, if you will, that leads to that result. But I don't think that's going to happen.
How do you feel – speaking of horrors, how do you feel – I'm sorry. I didn't know you were –
No, I was just going to say on the Aquinnah, where we've had a lot of activity. I actually spoke to the chairwoman right before I came in.
Of the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
And what was that?
She's great. We'll visit. I just wanted to acknowledge her letter, which, frankly, I'd heard about from a reporter before I saw it. And I told her that. But they're entitled to the respect of a sovereign nation, and she is as a leader. We have a lot of unambiguous or unequivocal legal opinion that, again, due respect to the tribe, that they have – the option, their option for gaming is through a commercial license. It's not as of right on gaming lands, and we're going to work our way through that, and I think we'll land where we are right now.
You know, Jim says the prospect of five casinos and a slot hall, whatever you said, but it could go the other way at the rate we're going here, too, with East Boston not approving the casino. I know there's some talk about it going to Revere. I'm not sure that that's actually feasible. Mm-hmm. Milford has a vote on Tuesday. We learned this morning the state can't complete the background check of the casino up in Milford because it hasn't identified a major source of its funding.
You mean the Gaming Commission?
Yes, exactly, the Gaming Commission. That's right. So it is possible that all that's left is Everett, where everybody seems to want it in Everett.
For Eastern Mass, for the Eastern
yes,
Mass casino?
Yes, exactly. So it could be a much smaller casino numbers built, or slots for that matter.
I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. I mean, that's what the bill contemplated, Marjorie. Not that there would necessarily be three resorts and one slot parlor, but that there could be up to that many. And the reason, you know, back to the earlier question from I think it was Mike, the reason for the local input is that individual communities may say, I kind of like the idea in the abstract, but I don't want it in my town, and that's okay.
Governor, one more thing about the potential for this ballot question on the ballot next year. And for those that know—
Still on casinos, you mean?
Yeah, on casinos. Mm-hmm. Scott Harshbarger, who is not exactly a bomb thrower, a former attorney general, ran for governor on the Democratic ticket, is one of the leaders. He was with us last week. I was speaking to somebody, you know, Charlie Baker, last night, who said, quote, he could consider voting for the repeal. Do you think casino fatigue has set in Massachusetts in general when they hear about the Caesars thing, the potential thing in Milford, the vote in is the environment changed from the day you signed the bill into law?
I don't know. I mean, it's probably too much to say that I'm sick of it. but this is not, look, this is not the centerpiece of our growth strategy or economic future by any means. This is an entertainment option, and there will be some jobs that come with it, I'm certain, with the facilities that that communities decide they want. And it doesn't all have to be done right away. It can be done over time and over the years. You know, you might try out one for a while and come back to it in a couple of years. A couple of years' time. That's okay.
Would that be a good outcome? I'm sorry to quote Charlie Baker a second time, but when he ran against you, his position was one casino, see how it goes. That wouldn't be a bad way to start in light of what we've gone through.
Well, you have a bill which allows for that. That's my point. It's not about we got to have three and one right away from day one, and if it didn't happen already, then the bill is a failure. You know, come on.
What do you mean? And one last thing. You said you're sick of the whole thing, and you were laughing. What are you sick of?
No, people ask me all the time. People, reporters,
yes.
Who are people, of course.
Yeah, but, some of them are, not all of them, but yeah, some of them are.
Reporters ask me all the time, you know, when there's a vote or a development of some kind, like the ones you mentioned, you know, what do you think about this? And I always say, you know, it doesn't matter what I think. The law leaves that to the commission. It's rather nice to have it left to the commission.
Okay, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we will mostly focus on your calls. I want to ask about a bridge that went up over a weekend,
which I think
is exciting. The governor will take your calls to 1 o'clock at 877-301-8970. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. This is part of the hour where the governor spends time with us and you in studio.
We're going to go back to the calls, and I want to acknowledge the emailers that are also worried about their insurance with the MassHealth Connector. We're going to give forward these emails to the governor's office so you'll have them. Okay, let's go back to the calls.
You know what? Let me also get the telephone number for the call center for people who have health insurance issues. If you're having trouble getting information on the website, and then we can broadcast that before.
That's what people are concerned about. One woman said she's concerned because she's been calling, and they told her she could not do it that way. She had to do it on the website. So we have several emails, and we'll forward them.
Yeah, no, we'll get to just people not to worry. Be patient. We will get folks sorted out. No one's going to be left high and dry if I have anything to do with it.
And you do. Back to the calls, Governor.
Margaret is calling from Lexington. Margaret?
Hello, Governor.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you.
Good. I'm calling. I want to change the subject slightly. I worked last spring and winter for the Campaign for Our Communities, which proposed a budget that was very much in line with what you were suggesting. And I'm rather disappointed that few of the programs were actually funded, and the budget didn't really get your budget didn't really get very far within the State House. And I want to know if you have any insights about what you might do differently or how you might advise us in the future to promote some of the items that you had on that agenda, including rail development and infrastructure improvement and that kind of thing, because I and others worked very hard for this kind of thing, and we're very disappointed that we didn't get any further.
Well, so Margaret,
I'd like to have your advice.
Thank you. Thank you, first of all, for working very hard. It did make a difference because, in fact, I think we won the point among most of the public, meaning that if folks wanted a truly up to date transportation system, and one where which would require, frankly, about a decade of consistent investment, and wanted the kinds of investments in education that assured universal pre-K, for example, a very high impact public investment in terms of strengthening the economy and the society over time, that it was going to require a modest increase in taxes. And the way we proposed to do that, as you recall, is to basically cut taxes, cut the sales tax, which is, I think, in many people's view, regressive, and have a modest increase in the income tax so that people who were doing better would contribute a little bit more. I think the concept – I think that approach for those reasons, according to all the polls, was the public was with us. I think that the business of legislating is hard. It's complicated. It takes getting a whole lot of different opinions to be voiced, to be heard, to be respected. I think, you know, we went on a campaign with your help and others in the larger public and in the building, but mostly in the larger public, to make sure everybody understood what we were talking about and had a chance to react to it and so forth. And there were many, many hearings as well. What came out of the legislature in the end, and I say this with due respect to the legislature, but as no surprise, was disappointing to me too. And in part because it came out on one day and they took a vote on it, you know, I think it was 6 or 7 days later without any hearings and with a lot of expressed frustration from me and from others that it wasn't actually meeting the needs. But, you know, the legislatures continue and administrations there'll be another administration soon. And I think you and the larger public and the legislature are going to have to come back to this. They didn't do nothing. Don't feel totally deflated. They did increase the gas tax by
$0.03, but with an inflation adjustment
with an inflation indexing. And that's a step in the right direction, no doubt about it. And then they moved a bunch of other things around in the budget to fund many of the priorities that were important to me and important to them and to you. So it's it wasn't a total win, but it wasn't a total loss either. And I think concerned and engaged citizens, particularly those thinking about the long term, like you, Margaret, are going to have to keep coming back at it, coming back at it through your reps and senators, and making sure that they feel they have that you have their back when they come in and take a tough vote.
Margaret, thanks, Nicole. Governor, while we're on the subject, since Margaret broached it, I know there have been a number of visits you've made around the state about some capital investments on the transportation front. Could you briefly tell us what some of those things are and end with my favorite, government happening in the last few weeks, a new bridge in a weekend on Clayton Street. So if you could do both, it'd be great.
Well, we have we've been using those new transportation resources and the rest of the capital plan to really invest in those things that we know grow opportunity and grow jobs in education, in innovation, and in infrastructure. And in the case of infrastructure, we have announced housing plans, various local transportation projects. I was out at in Westwood yesterday, for example, on a relatively modest grant, public grant that leverages millions in private investments in something called University Station.
Oh, I saw those pictures.
Did you see that?
Yes.
Yeah, it's a very cool thing. And actually, this idea of millions of dollars, but I mean in relative terms, a little public money leveraging a lot of private investment is a really winning strategy for us. And there are lots of examples of this around the Commonwealth. The project that you're excited about, Jim, I'm excited about too. This was the Clayton Street Bridge, which is a bridge that carries the Red Line. I think it's between Savin Hill and Fields Corner. And when a bridge on the Red Line is out of service, you got a real problem. On any rail line is out of service. So we used a technology and a method that we have been learning over the last few years. We did we built the bridge on the side and came up with a plan to take the old bridge down. We built the new bridge on the side to take the old bridge down and install the new one over a weekend so we could just disrupt service for a short period of time. And it went beautifully. It was finished ahead of schedule. And it was actually quite a marvel to see. We've done this before. It's the first time on a rail bridge, but we've done it on road bridges. And we did 14 of these bridges on I-93 North over 10 weekends 2 years ago. It's fantastic.
I love it. Let's go back to the calls, Governor Deval Patrick.
Let's see. Gary is calling from Framingham. Gary, you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi.
Good afternoon, Governor. Governor, I wanted to thank you for your historic support for disability programs from the time when you were head of the Office of Civil Rights through your administration. I wanted to briefly ask you, given the state of the budget, do you think that your FY15 budget you're preparing right now will be able to address the state's obligations to meet Chapter 257 and DAHAB obligations to increase the pay of low-paid community workers and also to support disability employment reform?
Gary, that's a mouthful. But
I usually give you that.
You do. I'm going to do my level best. I mean, I think, first of all, I want to thank you for acknowledging the work that we have done in the administration and that I've done before. And I think I know which Gary this is by the voice, a fabulous advocate for people with disabilities. And I hope you know that I see the population you serve. And I value the population as full members of our society. So we're going to do the very best we can. It's going to be a tough budget for reasons that came up in the context, really, of Margaret's question just before yours, as you know. But we'll look forward to working with you and doing the very best we can.
Gary, thank you very much for your call.
You know, Governor, I mentioned to you before the show. I was surprised
You're
to
pointing
read.
Pointing your finger
I'm
at
pointing
me.
My finger at you. That's right. I'm sorry.
For emphasis.
I shouldn't do that. But before the show, that I was surprised to read, I don't know if it was in the Herald or the Globe this morning, your salary is $139,000, which is no small amount of money. On the other hand, in Massachusetts, if you've got three or four kids, you've got a spouse that's at home, you know, the mortgages are huge, there's no governor's mansion here, it's not a lot of money. What do you think I mean, you're going, so you're not going to get a big raise yourself. But so this is not a self-serving thing that's going to help you. But what do you think is a reasonable salary? Because you have only rich people that can afford.
Well, on your last point, yeah. I am very worried about. I mean, I'm blessed. You know, I made a little money before I
in the private sector.
My wife still works in the private sector, but we are setting ourselves up, I think. To have the kind of set of circumstances where you have to be pretty well off in order to do the job, because there's other stuff that goes with it. You know, there's entertaining you should do. There's a, there's stuff you should do, and you know, mostly I either do that out of my own pocket or out of the pack that we have. Don't cry for me. I'm not.
No, I'm not crying for you, but you know what I'm saying.
I worry about that. You know, I remember reading about Jane Swift.
She struggled.
You know, sleeping on the sofa of her relative when she was here and then having to schlep 2.5-3 hours home to Williamstown. And it's, you know, you ought not have to have, you know, live in the neighborhood of Beacon Hill in order to be governor. The governor's salary is actually higher than 139. It's not much higher, but it's higher. And for a variety of reasons, I haven't taken those increases yet. As the economy has come back and the budget's gotten stronger, I might before it's all over. But there have been studies about what I think the mayor makes. Maybe twice that.
I think he makes. I don't know what he makes, but what do you think the governor should make in Massachusetts?
I don't know what
200 grand?
$200,000?
$500,000?
What's the bidding?
But you know the
issue. You know, they have this. I think is it Singapore, where they pay public executives what a private executive would get, and they get a really competitive group of contenders.
But really,
for those
you think
jobs.
About it. Charlie Baker did very well running Harvard Pilgrim. He's made, I think he's a millionaire. Mitt Romney, a millionaire many times over.
Yeah.
You did well in the private sector.
80 millionaires in the United States Senate, give
yeah,
or take one
so
or two.
It does mean that there's almost that if you are someone in Massachusetts, I mean, if you were in Mississippi or something, it would go a lot further. But in Massachusetts, that's not a big salary.
Yeah, it's not an issue you get a lot of sympathy on.
No, you don't. But it just – I was surprised by it, actually.
Did you ever think of – I mean, it's not just you. I mean, you're running close to a $40 billion enterprise. I know you know far better than I. Judges, the same deal, leaving the private sector and working for – I don't know what a judge's salary is, but it surely is not a huge
amount.
It's just gone up.
To
it's
what?
Just gonna. I don't remember what it was. Going up in two stages, starting January.
They could take weeks vacation.
But is this an impossible thing for anybody to really take on? Because even if you propose something and we're willing to take the heat, I'm assuming the vast majority of legislators don't want to have to go home and explain to people who are struggling to make ends meet why they just gave a real world increase to judges and governors and constitutional officers.
Well, the legislators did it in the last budget for judges. It was a big vote. It was an important vote, and they got a lot of encouragement to take that vote from business leaders and members of the private bar, because they get though money isn't the central reason why people come to actually it doesn't have anything to do with why people want to be a judge. You certainly want to. You want to pay enough to respect the position, the demands on the position, and not have to settle because you're not paying a living or a livable wage.
So how do you deal – very quickly on this. How do you deal with the fact – I mean Marjorie mentioned Charlie Baker did quite well at Harvard Pilgrim for a few years. You obviously worked at Coke and Texaco and did quite well there too. Let's assume people have – average jobs who want to lead the Commonwealth or be the Attorney General or whatever and make $72,000 a year or $46,000. The reality is they can't do it as a practical matter. They practically have to starve themselves. So what's the reform that allows real people to run for office and not be worried about their families?
First of all, Jim, there are a whole lot of people in state government who make $40,000, $30,000 and run to work.
Good point, yeah.
And run to work. And they bring – that spirit of public service to it, and it's an awe-inspiring thing. And, you'd want that same spirit in the people who run for office as well. And I think on the whole we have that. It's not a very sympathetic issue. It's unlikely to – maybe one day the business community will step up and say it's time for us to do – to, you know, kind of reexamine all this stuff and make some adjustments. I think it would probably have to come from them then before it comes from me.
Maybe you can make some real money being head of the Olympics campaign. Very quickly, you signed the bill that allowed there to be a commission to look into 2024. Is that real or is that some sort of fantasy?
Is the bill real?
No, I know it is. But, I mean, is the prospect of us having an Olympics in Greater Boston in 2024, is that even marginally real in your estimation?
You know, that's what the commission's supposed to sort out, whether it's feasible. I actually worked on something like this almost 20 years ago.
Which was
An initiative that John Hamill was then pushing. I was still in
from
practice.
From Shawmutter, one of the banks,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the head of the United States Olympic Commission came. We had a lunch for him and made a presentation, listened to him about what the prospects are might be and how to go about it. Whether it happens or not, the fact that we are willing to think big like that is important for this community. It is important. We need to start acting like the world-class community we are. And that means sometimes having big ambitions for Boston and for the Commonwealth and pursuing them, even if we don't win every one.
In that note, do you want to give us one sentence on the outgoing mayor and one sentence on the incoming mayor of Boston?
Love them both.
What's your working relationship like with Marty Walsh? The Herald did a story about a whole spectrum of initiatives you worked on. One of your people, I can't remember who issued the statement, said, we've actually reached out to him for some really important tasks during our campaign, during our governing. What is a good example of where you needed Walsh and he came to your defense?
Well, he's been a great ally. You know, I had to learn. There's been a lot of emphasis and you know, to my way of thinking, some of it overemphasis on his relationship with organized labor, mm-hmm. because his relationships go beyond that. But when I was getting started, I had to learn what to do in terms of, you know, how you engage with organized labor. How do you, you know, I was the long shot candidate. I wasn't a member of the establishment. I believe in collective bargaining, but I've also been on management side, so I get that that tension, that occasional tension. And he was enormously helpful in helping me understand what the issues are, what some of the language was, you know, and how to engage with people in a way that was respectful without, you know, just sort of throwing up my hands and saying whatever you want.
Fair enough. Let's try to get a couple of more calls in before you go, Governor.
Sure. Scheherazade. Am I pronouncing it right?
How great is that?
Scheherazade.
How exotic.
Yeah, it's a great name.
Calling from Quincy. How are you?
Fine, Governor. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
It's a different kind of question. How do you deal with the, shall we say, the font of affection that you engender from your own communities, women, the black females, as being the first black governor of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? It has been several decades since Edward Brooks and many, many years for New York since an Adam Clayton Powell or a David Dinkins in New York. How does a man in your position handle or deal with the agape, if you want to call it that, of the women or the teenage girls, if you will, the females in your own community who would embellish you with a communal affection and admiration.
Who knew?
For being the first black man to leave the state. What challenges does that present itself to you?
Wow. Thank you. thank you. I don't know that I have perceived a special font of affection from black women as a group. I do from the black women in my household, I'm happy to say. And that is a blessing. But no, I think, you know what, I get visits from time to time from school kids. Some by plan, and some are just in the hall, and you meet them. And when the kids come in, and you have a chance to, you know, actually talk with them or have them sit in the governor's chair and behind the desk and get their picture taken, that is a pretty special thing. And I hear later, and I get marvelous mail from the teachers or grown-ups talking about how that child months later, years later, is still talking about that visit. And that is meaningful in ways it's very hard for me to describe. I think because I know what an impact it was on me to have an adult pay attention to me and give me a sense of what it might be like to imagine a different path for myself. So if I'm able to do that for a kid, and I think I have been able to on a couple of occasions, it's pretty darn enriching.
Scheherazade, thank you for a great question.
That was a great question.
Let's try to squeeze
Governor,
one more in, Governor,
muffin.
If we can.
We didn't know. There you go.
Let's see. Alan is calling from Middleborough.
Hi, Alan.
Hello. How you doing?
How you doing?
I'm doing excellent.
Good.
Just to go back to a quick point that you were talking about salaries for public servants.
Mm-hmm.
I serve as a selectman in the town of Middleborough.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get paid a cent.
Mm-hmm.
So that's,
See, I told you there wasn't going to be much. I was going to say, I said to Marjorie that this was not a subject that was going to bring much, you know, sympathy. But
what's your question, Alan? We're
thank
short
you for
on
your
time.
Service in Middleborough.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for your service.
Thank you.
I'd like to know what the cost to the taxpayers has been for two negotiated compacts with the Mashpee Wampanoag tribe.
I don't have the number in front of me. I remember we got a budget from the legislature when the bill was passed for all of the outside legal work we were going to have to do a few million dollars. I don't remember what the actual expenditure has been. But if you want to hang on, Alan, we'll get some contact information and I can get it to you.
Alan, stay on hold. One of our producers will take your number. Governor, before you go, you asked your colleague here, Bonnie, to look up the number for the whatever the connector is now called.
Yes, I'm sorry I didn't have this at my fingertips. But if folks are having trouble with the website, or frankly, if they would just prefer to talk to a person to get enrolled in the subsidized plans, the number is 877-MA-ENROLL. 877-MA for Massachusetts, enroll, E-N-R-O-L-L. And that turns into 877-623-6765.
And as we say at the end of every visit by the governor, everybody who sent an email, they'll be forwarded to the governor's office, to which he will respond. And if the remaining people online want to hold and give their phone number to our producers, the governor's office will be in touch with the governor. It's great to see you.
Nice to be with
Thank
you.
You.
Happy
for
Thanksgiving.
Being
see you in
Thanksgiving
December.
To you and to all the listeners, and everybody be safe.
Governor
see you soon.
Deval Patrick joins us every month. We'll see him in December as well for Ask the Governor. When we come back, it's time for Open Mic with the Boston Globe's Alex Beam. That conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. Is Marjorie Egan. His name is Alex Beam for a reason. I want you to know before I say this, I did not write this introduction. I write many of them, but not this one. So listen, please. That's because, meaning Alex Beam, he shines a light on things that only his intellect can detect, illuminating the rest of us with his insight. He's also a columnist for the Boston Globe, author of numerous books. He has another one coming out soon, which we'll talk about. Alex, how are you?
I'm good, and it's great to be here. And by the way, you guys are great with the governor. He is astonishingly lifelike on your show.
Oh, that's
there
right.
There you go.
Now, you had a question. You were upset because you texted me, apparently, during the interview. I was supposed to check my text because you had a question.
You're always checking your text. You're incredibly
Maybe
rude.
I am.
You're really, really rude about
Thank
that.
Thank you. What was your question for the governor?
It was he had his hip replaced.
Yes, he did.
About 4 or 5 years ago. And I know he's a great squash player, and I'm a great squash player, and my hips are killing me. And I wanted to know if he's, inadvisedly, I might add, I want to know if he's back on the squash courts with his prosthetic hip? And he answered yes.
Oh, you these asked him in the hole?
These are the questions that you don't have the guts to ask. I have to do my own work.
I didn't know your hips were in disrepair. I'm sorry about that, Alex.
I'm sorry about it also.
Well, so I am dying to talk to you about this column you wrote about Oswald. I want to know, but we have two very prominent Catholics in Boston. You know, JFK, we're obsessed with him, the 50th anniversary of a piece about Oswald, and Cardinal O'Malley. You wrote about the Pope a couple of weeks ago, and we had a front page story in the Globe about Cardinal O'Malley as well. So why is November 14th, how many days to the assassination?
Days.
8 days? 8 days. We are still transfixed, or is it just the boomers that are transfixed?
Well, it is. I don't certainly it's the people who were alive on November 22nd, 1963. I think, you know, the three of us in this room, it's like September 11th, 2001.
Yeah.
For my kids, right? I mean, how could they ever forget where they were on that day? It's funny. I was prepared to speak about numerous bourgeois surrounding the memory of JFK. But I wrote that column about Oswald in a way because I wanted to say, although I the world certainly doesn't necessarily agree with me, I guess I wanted to make the point that one element of the JFK assassination, in my opinion, is nailed down. And it's not a majority opinion, but I wanted to...
Which, his motivation, or that he acted alone, or which?
Well, yes. He's the guy who shot the president, and that he acted alone, that he was not a cog in a larger machine. And I invoked these two writers, a new guy named Savodnik, who came out with an Oswald book, and then a lady who's been living in Cambridge for many years, who wrote the definitive biography of Lee Harvey Oswald. So, I mean, anyway, that's only speaking tangentially, I guess, to your point. But I was, I of course, educated once I published that piece because, you know, the internet nuttery machine just says, you know, I'm a tool of the CIA, Priscilla McMillan's a tool of the CIA, and it just never, it really never stops.
Well, you know what I didn't realize, a couple of things till I read your piece, that there was a theory that that part of Oswald's motivation was that he was an anti-capitalist America, like he would have been an SDSer had he lived through the later 60s. Really?
Well, that's, you know, I actually gave you Priscilla McMillan's phone number. That's what she writes in her extremely lengthy book. She feels he was ideologically motivated. He was, after all, a defector.
Yep.
You know, the very rare man or woman. There were five of them or something, like in the early 1960s. And four of them, quote unquote, defected because they met women that they liked in the Soviet Union. So he was arguably the only ideological defector from the United States. He actually went to the Soviet Union in order to defect. It's arguable. I mean, he was clearly pro Castro. You know, he was disturbed by the Kennedy administration's resistance to Castro, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
So, how did you describe those who don't buy into the "he acted alone" theory? As nuts? Is that what you said?
No, I didn't say
yes,
that.
You just did.
No, I said mine is not necessarily a majority view. I mean, I said that the internet nuttery machine reacted. I mean,
you know who came out just this past week saying, I was actually stunned to hear it in an interview with Tom Brokaw, who said he doesn't think he acted alone. He doesn't think it was a CIA connection. It may have been a Cuban connection. It may have been a Soviet Union connection. Was the Secretary of State of the United States of America, otherwise known as Louisburg Square's own John Kerry. I mean, that's a – but that is – don't make a face. He's making a face. I mean, that is – to matter-of-factly say 50 years after – by the way, the Warren Commission blew it. He didn't use – it's a pretty big deal.
Well,
no?
Lots of people think the Warren Commission blew it.
John Kerry is – what is he, fourth in line or something, or eighth in line for the – well, whatever.
Well,
he is.
No, he's third or fourth. For
yeah,
sure.
So, yeah, I mean, that's a pretty big deal, no?
You know, that is a big deal. It's weird because I was just warming to John Kerry before I heard that. I was just saying, like, here's a guy who's working hard for peace in Iran. I didn't know he said that. He's a smart guy. I'm not gonna. He's not alone in that view. Very, very intelligent people share that view. I don't share that view. I actually think the Warren Commission probably got it right. Again, that's not a particularly majority view. I don't know. I'm sure. I mean, it doesn't sound from your description that Kerry put anything on the table other than his doubts.
No. He said. In answer to a question from Brokaw, it was not a CIA. He doesn't believe it's a CIA connection. But he and I'm putting words in his mouth, but it was pretty much, and someone will email us if I'm way off, that the their the potential Cuban connections or Soviet connections he thinks deserve to be pursued. I mean, I considering the source, the timing, I thought it was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, no, he's a rational guy. Anyway, go ahead.
Well, you had another fascinating anecdote in the Stanley Oswald piece about some people believing that Oswald left the United States as Lee Harvey Oswald and came back as some other person and that they exhumed his body. I mean,
well, yeah. I mean, that was huge. And they did exhume his body, and they convinced Marina, his widow, you know, they needed her permission to do it. I identified that guy. He's a British lunatic. We can say anything we want about him because he's now dead.
Okay.
Who, you know, naturally he was hawking a book. And but, I mean, more insanely, you know, after I wrote that piece, I learned, you know, that James Reston Jr., who's sort of a nominally sane person, has published a couple of books, you know, son of the...
New York Times,
former editor of the Martha's Vineyard Gazette.
Is that so?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Go ahead.
Distinguished resident.
We're going to get to Martha's Vineyard in a few minutes, so go ahead.
Okay. So, I mean, he has a book out. I think it might be an electronic book or something. There's other interesting books, like your friend Lydon has been pushing an entirely different theory.
Lydon, yes.
Yeah. Reston is saying that, you know, Connally was the target of the assassination. And so, you know.
Governor of Texas.
Governor of Texas, who was in the limousine. Right, yeah. Right. In the limousine with JFK. I mean, which completely, you know, it's a mosaic. And if you take one piece out, everything changes. Now, Oswald, of course, wasn't intending to kill John Connally because he didn't know who he was. Oswald had only lived in Texas for a few months, blah, 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 blah. I mean, it never stops.
You know, but I don't want to get digress here, but there are some people, getting back to what you said, Alex, a couple of minutes ago, we're talking to Alex Bean from the Boston Globe. Some people think that when you left the Globe, you were replaced by another person before. No, but I know you don't
want to.
I know you
there was
talk.
A head transplant involved.
Talk. Okay,
drain the blood, put it back in as a different type.
Can we talk about another Catholic, prominent Catholic from Boston? Sean O'Malley has essentially gotten the email. Sean O'Malley, who talked a lot. I mean, Sean O'Malley, who not terribly long ago ended all adoptions through Catholic agencies rather than have gay couples adopt. So even heterosexuals couldn't adopt anymore. Now says, parroting the Pope, both of whom Marjorie and I are both huge admirers of the new Pope, I should say, saying enough of the culture wars. Let's focus on things like poverty. What you said when you read that, the front page of the Boston Globe, what was your reaction to that?
Well, that's getting the memo. That's pretty cynical.
Well, but it's true, obviously.
We're cynical.
This is a guy who boycotted the Prime Minister of Ireland speaking at BC because the Prime Minister had the audacity to support an abortion law change in the case of the life of the mother.
And the front page of the Globe today is talking about the bishops. Right. They're all suddenly turning to the left after Francis.
Well, right. I quote unquote skimmed that article. I thought it was more about this. The memo had been distributed to everybody. I mentioned in a column a few weeks ago this detail that nobody noticed, nor should they have. You know, O'Malley is on a what essentially is sort of a concilium. He's on a special secret committee of counselors.
The only American, correct?
Yeah, the only American. It's a committee of eight, as I understand it, in the Jesuit tradition. It's an extremely important sort of kitchen cabinet. So I didn't take that away from the Globe piece, which I also didn't read. I mean, because I knew O'Malley was on board, so to speak. I mean, and if the rest of these troglodytes get on board, I mean, obviously more to the good. We talked about this in the past, actually. And I mean, people, whether deeds will follow words is, of course, the big skepticism among Catholics.
Deeds will follow words in terms of the bishops or in terms of the Pope?
Both.
You don't think the Pope, at least at minimum, you mean in terms of the abortion and gays and
thing? They're never going to change an abortion.
There's so many things.
They can certainly change on birth control. They can change on divorce and remarried Catholics. They can change. They could change on women as well. They could certainly change on married
women
priests.
As priests, yeah.
Priests were married well into the 1200s.
Don't you think that? Don't you think that's the next change? Is allowing either formerly married, let's say married men to be priests because there's a priest. I mean. Not in Africa
in the
or
back
South
door,
America.
That's right. As you know, the Anglicans.
I'm not Catholic. We've been over this ground before, but I mean, I believe even oblate priests, some oblate priests. Are, I mean, I'm not, but I believe there's a back door there.
Back door.
Already.
It's a shame if you had read that article in the Globe, you would have known what you were talking about. You know what I mean?
Life's Alex, too short, my
hey,
friend.
Hey, Alex, you mentioned it a couple of minutes. We just mentioned two prominent Catholics who from this area. Let's talk about two major, potential major undertakings. When you heard, and I have to admit, I thought of you almost immediately. I don't even know why. When you heard there might be a casino in Martha's Vineyard, what was the first reaction?
This
is a guy who has created a cottage industry out of making fun of Harvard, by the way. So that's one of the. That's why I thought of you. What do you think about the Martha's Vineyard deal?
I don't. I bet I don't think anything original from anyone who's been. I listened to your show yesterday. I know you talked to some smart people. It was just so bleeping hilarious.
It's great. It's great.
Great.
Who from Harvard is down there? Do you know who Summers
the
there?
Skipper.
The
skipper's there.
Skip
Gates, yes.
I bet the skipper wants a tawdry casino in his backyard. But also, I don't get to Martha's Vineyard as much as I used to put it mildly. But isn't Aquina, as some people call it, I believe more or less abuts on the Jacqueline Kennedy holdings. It's not at all far from.
I am not familiar with the geography of Martha's Vineyard and the locale of Mrs. Onassis.
I can assure you that the
Caroline still owns it, does she not?
Yes, yes. I think they sold off part of it.
They sold off part of it.
The best call yesterday, speaking of yesterday, if you weren't tuned in, is Dan from Worcester, who's a conservative soul, was the first caller and said something like, I cannot wait till a boatload of people who are totally half in the bag get off, pee on Carly Simon's lawn, and then go. It was pretty great.
And the buses. Can you just imagine the buses going
out
to that?
Oh, yeah, and
the
hot tin roof. I mean,
so let me ask
Carly
you. Carly
Simon.
We know you're a big gambler. What would you say the odds of there being a casino on Martha's Vineyard are?
About 500,000 to one. When Dick Friedland weighs in with his pal.
That's right.
Bill Clinton,
that's right.
Believe me.
He has the house that Clinton stayed in for all those years, correct? And Dick Friedman, what does he own in Boston?
The Charles Hotel,
which is where all major Democratic events, at least in Cambridge. Yeah. You know, you've written about this. Where are you in general? I mean, I'm an anti-casino guy in general. Where are you? Are you an agnostic like Marjorie, or where are you?
You know, I'm not an agnostic, and I was sort of emotionally reacted decades ago when I learned that Scott Hershberger was against gambling, I guess because he's the child of a minister, I think.
A Lutheran minister, but he also thinks, I think he's used the expression fool's gold. I mean, he's worried about the impact on poor people and he doesn't think it creates, I don't want to speak for him, the jobs that are promised.
Well, I'm just down with the religious objection.
Other than Celeste Myers,
yes,
the religious leaders in East Boston were huge in the outcome there. So where are you in this?
No, I tell you, I have only, I could debate either side of it rationally, but I respect the religious opposition, and I'm with the religious opposition.
You ever been to a casino?
Yeah, I have. Foxwoods is, I've never been to the other one down there, but Foxwoods is genuinely fascinating. You know, there's two books written about, the deal that Weicker cut. They're utterly fascinating.
We interviewed a guy from the Wall Street Journal about 10 years ago who wrote one of those books about what happened to the members of the tribe who opened, I don't know which casino it was, and about what havoc it wreaked in their lives. Virtually all of them became millionaires in fairly short order. Is that where you're going with this?
No, that's not what I'm going with, but I'm very much aware of that. I mean, because my friend Danziger and I went to visit the kind of beautiful suburb that was built with Foxwoods money. And, it ain't no pretty picture. I mean, money is not everybody's friend. Money was not, if I'm allowed to call them the Indians as a generalization, it was not the Indians' friend in that situation. I happen to be much more interested in Weicker's rather canny.
Lowell Weicker, former governor, former senator.
Well, Weicker walked away from the negotiations with a $250 million annual guarantee for the state of Connecticut. And I mean, I think people said on your show yesterday, I mean, the point is this is an endless cycle of diminishing returns. So Weicker at the time is incredibly intelligent because he's getting the biggest piece of the biggest pie. Now there's Mohegan Sun is already next door there, so the piece is already 50% smaller. You know, these guys in Massachusetts, I know it's a huge deal, and I heard Steve Crosby, I like Steve Crosby, blah, blah, blah.
Chair of the Gaming Commission.
Right, but I mean, the pie is much, much smaller now. Massachusetts will not be able to shake these people down for $250 million a year. I mean, God knows, what the available pool of people, who are willing to throw away their money, da, 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 da.
Yeah, and also, I think that the fury was much greater when we were in the worst part of the recession. Midway through 2008, 2009, and there was this sense of desperation. I mean, the economy obviously has not recovered to the degree we wanted to, but I don't have that same sense of desperation now that there was 4 or 5 years ago.
Well, surely you can get Barney Frank on the show, right? I mean, I thought he was a pretty serious advocate.
He yelled at me when I said that these were not great jobs. One of the first times we discussed, he just called in cold. And I think it's a fair description. He said mockingly of me, okay, Jim, let's do this. Let's build the casino.
We really
hire 4,000 people. And then as soon as you find better jobs for those people in Fall River, we'll shut down the casino and replace it with that. Now, last thing from me, Alex Beam, right. Speaking of major undertakings.
Well, he was a tireless advocate for his constituents.
Yes, he was.
I admired him for that.
That's the thing. If 87% of people in Everett want the casino, I say, let them have it in Everett. If in my
hometown,
Fall River.
What if you live in the next community? I mean, one of the reasons why Marty Walsh, excuse me.
It's a total not-close-to-me deal.
Excuse
me.
One of the reasons Marty Walsh, when he was on with us last week, the mayor-elect, we said, I was surprised he answered the question. We said, where would you like the casino? It'd be Revere if there's a Suffolk Downs plan there, Milford, and where did he pick? Milford. And what was his rationale?
Because
it's the farthest away from Boston.
Exactly. But I mean, if an entire community votes and they have job problems there, or like I say, Fall River, where they could use the jobs, that's different to me than when you have a divided community like East
Boston. Well, they're on an island. But in any case, so let me read you the text I got from Alex, which segues in the last point. Says, can you ask Deval Patrick about, this is like a personal question for Alex, about his hip replacement. He still plays squash. Now, the segue here is, speaking of squash.
Yeah, okay.
There could be.
Yeah, cruelly banned from the Olympics.
Then I can't even ask the question. I was going to ask, can you wait 10 years till they're playing squash in the Olympics in downtown
cruelly
Boston?
Cruelly banned.
Always.
Outrageous.
I was in an event, in fact, in Boston, where the entire Egyptian delegation didn't show up because they were lobbying
the
IOC.
Is this true?
Yes, absolutely. Symphony Hall. They have a big squash event. They put a squash court inside of Symphony Hall once a year. Yeah.
And they were lobbying the International Olympic Committee to keep squash in as an Olympic sport?
No, it's never been.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Because the Pakistani military doesn't rule the IOC. I mean, it's utterly hilarious. They always make this huge case about how, you know, tens of millions of people play squash, blah, 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 blah. And in fact, if you live in Pakistan, that's absolutely true. Like, everybody plays squash in Pakistan. Okay.
So,
What about curling? Curling, where they have the brooms and the puck and they...
People like curling.
But that is incredible that curling has survived all these years and... Squash?
Squash has never been in. It'll never be in.
Forget squash.
Yeah, exactly. Squash is so uninteresting.
I was surprised. When we asked Deval Patrick about this, 30 minutes ago, even though we didn't get to Alex's question, I know it was a problem. Deval Patrick was totally into exploring this as a real option. What do you feel as a greater Bostonian? How do you feel? I mean, we need a camera for this. Alex makes a face at every question. And this I can't even describe this one. Yeah. How do you feel about an Olympics coming? We could have the aquatic events near you.
Yeah.
I
actually prepared an answer for this, which is my position is get the Walk for Hunger out of Boston.
That's what Marjorie thinks, too.
Do they go down your street as well?
Absolutely. You and I have written columns on that.
That's right.
And yet they don't heed us. They don't listen to us.
They block the streets off. Alex, have you not written several... nasty, mean-spirited columns about synchronized swimming?
No, I have not. I don't know. I actually, because...
Why not?
Well, because the women wear very scanty bathing suits, if you must know.
Oh, that is not...
Duh.
Yeah,
I mean, come on.
They do? I thought they were in much more serious one-pieces.
One-piece suits are very sexy, Marjorie.
And they have the bathing caps on. And they have the nose plugs.
Okay, that's all.
Use your imagination.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, fine. Now, Alex Beam was a pleasure. Was it for you?
Is it over?
Yeah, it's done.
What the hell? I thought we were going to talk about the Olympics.
Are you having fun?
Well, do you have a thought about the Olympics?
Yeah, I'm against it. I don't think it's going to happen. This is such a wonderful city. Let's not besmirch it with the Olympics.
By the way, does every Globe columnist play squash?
They fired all the ones who play squash. David Greenway.
Okay, goodbye. Alex Beam, it's a pleasure.
Oh, God. Is he going to Martha's Vineyard or is he already there?
No, I think he's already there.
Okay.
In permanence.
We'll talk about your next book next time you're back, by the way.
Thank you very much, Alex Beam. Always fun to talk to you. I hope your hips improve before we talk to you again.
Thank you.
When we come back, we are continuing our You Are Not Alone series with a look at something called the longevity dividend. Stick around to hear more about that. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And we are continuing our series on aging and caregiving with a look at what the future may hold. According to the AARP's Public Policy Institute, in about 15 years, the number of caregivers will start to decline. That includes both paid caregivers and unpaid ones, like a family member, a friend, that kind of thing. So maybe the way around this predicament is to ask, not who will take care of me when I'm old, but how can I live longer without taking on the complications that come with aging? Joining us to talk about this and what he calls the longevity dividend, which I love the term, is Jay Olshansky. He's a professor in the School of Public Health, University of Illinois, Chicago. He's also a research associate at the Center on Aging at the University of Chicago. Jay Olshansky, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.
So tell people, I think this is absolutely fascinating, Jay, about this longevity dividend. What is it?
Well, the short version is basically the suggestion that the time has arrived to take a new approach to the diseases and disorders that tend to kill us. You know, we've added about 30 years to life expectancy in a little over the last century. And one of the consequences of that is the rise of heart disease, cancer, stroke, Alzheimer's, things that we don't like. And the approach that we take to them today is to attack them as they arise, one at a time. There have been enough developments in the last decade or so in the scientific study of aging to suggest that a new target is in front of us, and that's the biological process of aging itself. And if we could slow aging, even by just a small amount, the health and economic dividends to individuals and populations we've documented are huge. So a new approach to public health is approaching us.
And so just to go back to what you said to begin with, obviously there's never been a time in human history where the average life expectancy has expanded at that kind of rate in such a short period of time. And that's because of we saw your phenomenal video, which we'll reference in a second. That's because of the advent of public health initiatives, correct?
Yes, we saved the young from dying from infectious diseases. Basic public health, hand washing, and the like were extraordinarily effective. In the latter part of the 20th century, medical technology has brought down the risk of death from heart disease, from stroke, from some forms of cancer. And those are all good. I mean, these are major advances in public health. But it's created a dilemma. I mean, now the trade-off is we're now seeing things that we don't like at later ages. And it's distinctly possible, that continuing to go after the diseases that kill us, as we do now, may in the end prolong the period of frailty and disability. It may make us older longer, the very thing that we don't want. So we're in a very unusual situation in our modern world, and that calls for new approaches to public health.
And what are the new approaches that would slow the aging process, and how are they within reach, or are these pipe dream things at the moment?
Well, if they were pipe dreams, we wouldn't be talking about them. Well,
no,
some people are still talking about them. I can tell you that people have been trying to sell pipe dreams to the public for thousands of years, and they didn't work. But the science of aging has advanced dramatically. Now, I'm not going to go into detail here, of course, but let me give you one example, and actually is taking place in part in Boston. And that is there's some researchers, for example, Tom Pearls at Boston University, who studies the genetics of long-lived people, of centenarians, people who live past 100. These individuals that are very healthy and very old are in all likelihood genetically different than the rest of us. They are probably growing old at a slower rate, so that 1 year of clock time to them does not generate 1 year of biological time. And what researchers are trying to find, this is just one example of many, by the way, they're trying to find out what the secret is that these individuals possess and find a way to transfer whatever genetic advantage those individuals have to the rest of us. So slower aging is all around us already, and we're trying to figure out how to transmit that to the rest of us.
But you know what I wonder about the genetic difference among people? You sometimes see, someone whose parents or lived well into their 80s or 90s, and you think, oh, my goodness, that's great. I'll probably live to my 80s or 90s. And then all of a sudden you keel over at an earlier age, or you develop some dread disease in an earlier age. So genetics that you always hear play such a big role. Sometimes they do and sometimes they don't.
Well, the phrase that I use often to describe the phenomenon you refer to is the only control we have over our duration of life is to shorten it. And we exercise that control all the time. We smoke, we drink, we walk in front of buses. We do things that are generally harmful to our health. And if you avoid those things, then the genetic potential that you were born with for longevity is allowed to be expressed. Now, it's important to remember, of course, that it's not a perfect relationship between genetics and longevity. And so there are random events that occur in our bodies with the passage of time that are not our fault. And actually, that's a very important point to emphasize, is that most of what goes wrong with us as we grow older, especially into very old age, is not our fault. It's a consequence of using our bodies beyond what I refer to as their biological warranty period. Very much like your automobile. If you use it too long, things start to go wrong. If you use your body longer than it was originally intended, things start to fall off.
We're talking with Jay Olshansky. He's a professor in the public in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois in Chicago and a research associate at the Center on Aging at the University of Chicago. So tell people, Jay, what do we know now about the kind of things that research scientists know already that would prolong your age besides the lucky gene thing?
Well, look, the one thing that you can do now, short of waiting for these technologies to come on board, is to do what we know works to improve quality of life. And I would emphasize, by the way, that the work that's being proposed on the scientific study of aging is not designed for the purpose of making us live longer. Life extension is not the goal. The goal is to extend the period of healthy life.
Yeah.
And the one thing that we know works now, and your mother and grandmother told you this probably, and that's diet and exercise. That diet and exercise is roughly the equivalent of an oil, lube, and a filter for your car. You don't have to do it, but if you do, it makes your car run better. Diet and exercise can make your body run better. It basically, you're allowing your body to exhibit the latent potential for longevity that you were born with. Short of that, there really isn't much you can do to influence your duration of life. Maybe reducing your caloric intake a little bit will make you healthier longer. But short of these advances in biomedical technology, there really isn't that much. Monitoring, of course, is critical.
Especially blood pressure, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, going to your physician, right, every year just to monitor your body, to see how things are progressing with time, these are critical. You know, the odd thing is that my father, who lived to 96, actually almost never went to a doctor, ironically enough, and he actually ended up suffering the last 10 years of his life because of prostate problems that could have been avoided had he been willing to go to a doctor earlier in his life. So going to your doctor for routine maintenance is absolutely critical, and that's about that's the control that you have.
We're talking to Jay Olshansky. Jay, let me borrow a phrase that's been used far more beautifully than I'm about to. There is a fierce urgency of now, though. When you talk about what the work you and your colleagues are involved in, and you pair that up with what I mentioned at the top about these frightening AARP numbers, and their function, for those who didn't know about these, obviously of the aging of the baby boomers. They say, for example, in 2010, there were 7.2 individuals of prime caregiving age, 45 to 64, for every person over 80. By 2030, that ratio is going to be almost cut in half to 4.1 for every person over 80. So if it turns out that we don't not only live longer, but live healthier, as you're talking about this longevity dividend, people are going to be in real trouble because the support systems won't be there, correct?
That's correct. AARP's numbers are right. We're in a very unusual situation in the U.S. and elsewhere. You know, we have about 10,000 people a day turning 65, and that's going to go on for at least another 16, 18 years or so. And the proportion of the population that's going to be older will rise fairly rapidly. And with you pair that with declining birth rates, and you've got a very unusual situation in terms of caregiving. So, and I would pair that, by the way, with the additional news that we will continue to succeed in our efforts to combat heart disease, cancer, stroke, the things that kill us. And again, it's good at one level. You achieve some short-term benefit in terms of life extension, but people then live longer to experience something else. If you lower the risk of heart disease, that individual will eventually die from something else or experience something else, and they may not like what they see. So the scenario that we've placed ourselves in is a very unusual one. The urgency is there because the demographics are there. Changes are occurring very rapidly. Caregiving is becoming more of an issue. And so the time has arrived for this new approach to public health, and I think it's beginning to take off quite nicely. We're getting traction.
Well, that's part. When you say take off, you mean the consequence of your work. But do people outside the world in which you work, do they get it? Does government get it? Do foundations get it? Are there more people doing what you do because of this urgency? Or is it just this cadre of people who've been doing what you do for a while?
Well, the government is getting it. Actually, just a couple of weeks ago, there was a major meeting in Washington, D.C., which brought together researchers from all the major institutes to discuss issues just along these lines. So the government gets it. The director of the National Institutes of Health gets it. Foundations are getting it. I mean, you may have seen the story that came out just a month or so ago about Google, the CEOs of Google creating a company called Calico. And
no.
The idea was to invest in the very thing that we're talking about here, to slow down aging and extend the period of healthy life. So, yes, I think the world is beginning to see it. And our job, of course, is to translate all of these ideas into therapeutic interventions that will help the entire population, not just the privileged few.
You know what I wondered, J.L. Shansky, and J.L. Shansky is an expert, obviously, you can tell, on public health and aging as well. Are there people, we were thinking about this before the show, are there people that you can think of that are really pretty old but have aged pretty well, that are kind of with it, that we would recognize? Jimmy Carter was one we came up with. He's got to be well into his 80s. He seems to be doing pretty well.
You know, it's funny you should ask that, because just last year I published a book chapter entitled The Elders, and this was devoted to identifying a number of individuals that from a variety of professions, by the way, that have made it out to older ages with their mind and body intact, and these individuals are absolutely exceptional. You know, one of the things that we've done in the modern era is we've created this asynchrony between mind and body. So you get some people out to older ages with their body working well and their mind is gone, and some people with their mind working well and their body is gone. So we've worked hard to create this asynchrony. And when you see them both together working well at older ages, it's absolutely remarkable. So people like Jimmy Carter and the earlier version of Nelson Mandela, but you know, a number of individuals that have made it out into their 70s, 80s, and 90s. George Burns, for example, were exceptionally healthy. And I'd point out, by the way, that I think it's only a matter of time before our major sex symbols become postmenopausal women.
Do you know the great George Burns story? George Burns is sitting on as a guest on Johnny Carson's Tonight Show, I believe either on the day of or right after he turned 90. And Johnny Carson turns to George Burns, obviously of Burns and Allen, for those who don't recall. And so George, do anything differently now that you're 90 as compared to what was before? He says, no. He says, well, actually, one thing. He says, every time I bend over to tie my shoes, I see what else I can do while I'm down there.
Hey, hold on. You skipped over the most fascinating thing I've heard in ages, that the new sex symbols are going to be postmenopausal women. You're singing my tune here, Jay. What makes you think that?
Well, you know, it's funny. That issue came up years ago when I did an interview with Barbara Walters, and she sort of caught on to that as well. You know, I think in general the view of aging that many people hold is that aging is generally associated with loss, decline, decay.
Right.
And, you know, when I have this discussion with my students, I ask them, is there anything good about growing older? And they shake their heads. No. All of them say the exact same thing. No. I can't think of a single thing that's good about growing older. And then I actually spend a good portion of the rest of the semester exploring all of the positive aspects of aging, one of which is sexuality, one of which is, comfort in your own skin. Look, if you could take all of the benefits associated with growing older that we accumulate as we age and put them in a pill and sell it to the public, the first ones in line would be teenagers. You know, these are kids that are not comfortable in their own skin. They haven't figured out their own sexuality yet. They're not making any money. They're not nearly as intelligent or wise as older people. You put it in a pill, I'm telling you, it's an extraordinarily valuable concept, and I'm guessing that sexuality is one among many attributes of aging that we're eventually going to discover is actually positive.
Hey, Jay, we only have 1 minute left, Jay Olshansky. Do a Nostradamus thing. Take us 10 years, 15 years into the future, and we're having this conversation. Where are we?
What I'm hoping happens is that a therapeutic intervention makes its way to the general public, hopefully in the form of something very simple, like a pill that we would be able to take at younger, middle, and older ages, that hopefully will make us age more slowly, that hopefully will create less than 1 year of biological time for each year of clock time. Imagine taking 50 years to turn 40 or 60 years to turn 40. That's what we have in mind.
Well, let me end with two words from both me and Marjorie beyond thank you. Work fast, Jay, if you would. Jay, it's great to speak to you. Yeah. Thanks so much for your time.
And don't forget to text us when the big breakthroughs come through. Jay, thank you. It's fascinating.
Oh, by the way, we will put online, I should say, this fabulous 3.5-minute video that Jay and a colleague have done about sort of the history of public health, where we started, where we're going. It is brilliant, Jay. And we'll make it available at WGBHnews.org. Jay, thanks for your time.
Thanks. Most appreciated.
Jay, as I said before, Olshansky, professor in the School of Public Health at the University of Illinois in Chicago. He's also a research associate for the Center on Aging at the University of Chicago. Jay, it was great to talk to you. When we come back, we're going to look at the suburbs. And is their purpose the way we perceive them changing? I should say, we'll look at the suburbs. And is their purpose the way we perceive them changing? That is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Are cities and suburbs doing some sort of role reversal? You know, it used to be the well-heeled would move to the suburbs and enjoy the big house with the driveway, the lawn. But today, apparently, some folks with money are leaving the suburbs to become city slickers, while the high cost of housing is forcing lots of low- and middle-income urban dwellers into the suburbs. Joining us to talk about this reverse osmosis, I guess you'd say, is Kara Miller. She is host of the Innovation Hub. Hello, Kara.
Hey.
Hey. So why is this happening?
Yeah, well, it is this amazing flip. So if you go back 100 years, so let's just go back for a second. 100 years ago, three times as many Americans lived in cities as lived outside cities, which is not surprising. People were coming through Ellis Island. This was a nation of immigrants. And where was sort of the first place that very poor people stopped? New York City, right? Yep. And San Francisco. And then a lot of our sort of ancestors were those people who stopped in cities, lived in very poor, you know, tenements in places like Brooklyn and stuff, right? And then once they had some money, as Jim was saying, they got some land, right? They got to move out to a place where they had a lawn and their kids could run around. So you saw that big change happening in the 1940s, particularly. There's this guy named Bill Levitt, who famously built Levitt Town, right? He was at his height building over 30 houses a day.
Wow.
Just the Levitt Building Company was building over 30 houses a day. They'd have people come through, put the slab down. They didn't bother with putting in basements or anything. So put the slab down. The next person come, you know, do the pipes. The next person. It was basically the Model T assembly line brought to suburbia to see how fast they could put these houses together for GIs who were coming back and wanted to have families.
Long Island? Was Levittown,
yep.
Long Island?
That's yeah,
the home of Bill O'Reilly, by the
exactly.
way.
Exactly. Yeah. They bought some potato fields and put up thousands of houses. And so one of the fascinating things that we're seeing now is the rich are moving back into cities. I don't know if you saw it, but a few days ago, the Boston Globe, I've been working on this for a while, but the Boston Globe had this story saying Downtown Crossing, and this kind of blows you away, right?
I did see it.
Downtown Crossing, which used to be this place that was not very safe and you kind of didn't want to go. And who even lives in Downtown Crossing, right? I mean, are there even places to live? Is now more expensive than the Back Bay by about $100,000 a pop.
Isn't that incredible?
Yes. And so that is happening, but that's not just happening in Boston. That is happening in Boston for sure, that the rich are leaving the suburbs and moving into the city. But that's happening in New York. Think about what's happened to places like Brooklyn. Did anybody used to live on Wall Street? No, but it's almost a residential neighborhood now.
With strollers.
Exactly. It's happening in downtown Phoenix. It's happening in downtown Cleveland. It's happening in downtown Detroit. I don't know if you saw that 60 Minutes piece, but the only part of Detroit that has it together is this super urban core, which is very hip and happening. It's a really interesting thing that's going on.
So essentially, it is a reversal. Middle-class people, I assume, for the most part, or to a great degree, can't afford to live in the city.
That's right.
And rich people who used to leave the city because of schools and crime now are moving back from the suburbs. Are they waiting until their kids are out of school? You know, that great story, speaking of the Globe, is a story every year when the MCAS results come out, and it always shows that the town in Massachusetts that has the highest MCAS scores has huge real estate value.
Weston.
Harvard or so. No, it's usually Harvard or one
Westwood,
of those kind of places
something.
And that kind of thing. So there is a total reversal of what we were used to in past decades, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in terms of, you know, do people wait until they're like empty nesters and then move into the city? Because obviously it's very hard to get 3,000 square feet in downtown Boston.
Yeah.
That, I mean, you can if you've got $4 or $5 million, but it's hard to get. I think that's one of the really interesting questions. I asked a bunch of experts about this, and a lot of people say that the millennials, people born in 1980 or after, are actually fundamentally different, that they will settle for 1,000 square feet in a downtown area in San Francisco, let's say, versus moving out to the suburbs and getting to have 2,500 square feet, which in past times, that's what people wanted. People wanted granite countertops. And they wanted a place where they could put up a swing for their kids.
But apparently these stories in these books on this topic say that those millennials, they want what only a city can offer.
That's right.
Which is both the cultural environment. They don't want to drive a car. They want to be able to walk places.
Right.
They want to do the bike thing, which obviously is expanding by leaps and bounds, at least in Boston, I'm sure in other communities.
That's right. And you see a very interesting thing happening with companies, too. There are companies now that I've seen move into Boston. I've heard people complain and say, look, I want to live in Boston because you've got these recent Harvard and MIT grads who do not want to move out to the suburbs. They want to take the T to work. They are unwilling to drive out to the suburbs. So I'm going to have to turn around and move my company in. And you actually see Twitter boasts that they are in downtown San Francisco, unlike these old school tech companies like Apple that's in Cupertino and Google that's in Mountain View. It used to be that it was great to get these big campuses and have these big parking lots where everybody could put their cars. It does not seem to be what people want anymore.
Well, you know, it's a fascinating thing in Boston. One of the things you heard a lot in the mayoral race, and I heard this a lot from my friends who live in Boston, who wanted to stay in Boston and like Connor because they thought it was going to be more radical in the schools because they did not want to have to move to the suburbs. They liked it. And, of course, Boston has all these neighborhoods like Jamaica Plain and Roslindale that are kind of suburban in feel, but they do have the T and they are still within the city of Boston. So that was a big appeal. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. If you want to weigh on this, are you someone who's lived in the burbs, kids are growing up and saying, I'm coming back to the city? Are you somebody who's living in the city, planning on raising your family in the city and going to stay? You don't want to move to Wellesley. You don't want to move to Newton. And that's the other thing, too, that you have to move further and further from the city to get a reasonably priced house. I mean, you can't just move to Wellesley without paying an arm and a leg. So you'd have to go to Arlington. Used to be cheaper. Now Arlington is becoming more expensive, too, because
exactly.
The school's getting better.
Exactly. Well,
just
I mean,
go
so
to Framingham,
well, a couple
I guess.
Things are happening. So and one thing is the further out you move, the more time you spend stuck in traffic, right?
Right?
And that's a real downside. The other thing that's happening is not only are you seeing a reversal of money, but you're also seeing cities getting a lot whiter. It used to be that downtown cities were not places that if people could choose, they wanted to live. They tended to be heavily minority, very poor. I think of downtown Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Now those are places where white families with young children are starting to move, which was something that 30 or 40 years ago people could not fathom. So you see cities getting whiter and suburbs getting more diverse.
877-301-8970. Are you suffering through, I don't know, suburban urban angst? I mean, it makes sense, particularly the millennial thing. We started talking about the rich coming back and poorer people not being able to afford to live in the city anymore. But it is true. I mean, the 20-somethings and the 30-somethings, there's a certain quality of life. This is not to disparage the suburbs, even though it gives me hives when I even travel there. I'm sorry. I'm a city boy. I have been my whole life. But there is a certain something, particularly with a more environmentally conscious citizenry, a more fitness-focused citizenry, people like to go to restaurants or at least food places where they can get higher quality, you know, all that sort of thing. It really does make sense to me. So we want to know
politics.
At 877-301-8970, where are you in this urban-suburban divide? And particularly interested in talking to you if your worldview about that has changed in recent years. What do you mean politics?
The politics. Well, I think there's a lot more Democrats living in big cities, you know, so you might have more like-minded people. We always talk about this in elections. So when the urban vote comes in, and I'm not talking, you know, people that are middle class or poor people. I'm talking about wealthy people. I mean, you find a lot of very wealthy likely Democrats.
Well, it turned out that one of the biggest indicators of whether you were going to vote for Obama was whether you walked or took public transportation to work. If you did, you were, I mean, which totally makes sense, right? You think about people in New York and, you know, taking BART out in the Bay Area or here taking the T. Almost certainly those people are voting for Obama.
Yeah, but keep in mind, New York City, which votes for Obama, has not had a Democratic mayor before de Blasio in something like 20 years. Robert, you were in Boston. You were first on Boston Public Radio with Kara Miller. Hey, Robert.
Hey, how you doing?
Excellent.
So I'm a third-generation Cotton Square resident.
Mm-hmm.
I've grown up in Dorchester my whole life. I'm very blessed that way. And one thing I've been really interested to see over the past few years is how many people are purposely moving from the suburbs back to the city or even to the city for the first time because they want to experience living in a true community. They want their kids to know their neighbors. They want to walk to a community health center like we have in Cotton Square. They want to get involved. And they said that when they're living out in the suburbs, there was no ability to get involved outside of soccer practice for the kids. And it's been absolutely amazing to watch.
You know, Robert, I'm dying to know because I've noticed this having worked in Boston for a long time now. Dorchester, Cotton Square, the whole area has changed dramatically for the better.
Throughout my whole life, I tell everyone it gets better every year. I mean, we have many reasons for that, but the most important thing is the people who are here. Both the ones who've been here long term and the people who are coming here are here for a reason. They're not here because of a popularity contest or to see who can have the biggest trophy house. People are putting down roots and they want to get involved. And growing up, I ran the neighborhood association around here and always amazed that we never had that like NIMBY situation. People always want to know more before passing judgment or supporting something. It's a marked change. You know, we have a couple of neighbors who moved from Newton because they want to get more.
Oh, we lost you. What's the end of that? I would die in here. The end. Are you still there, Robert? Or we cut you off. I think he had a cell phone failure. Robert, thanks for the call.
I love that call, you know, partially because, you know, for example, when Robert says, look, people are moving into the city because they really want to live here. And this is, you know, I'm third generation and this is really, I'm seeing something change. I was reading a piece that actually Amanda, who works on both of our shows, sent me from Politico, and it was looking at Red Hook in Brooklyn, which I think of as this very trendy place. It was talking about how in the 50s it was like filled with prostitutes and drugs. I had no idea. I thought it was the place to live, you know? But that is what, you know, you see places undergoing this amazing evolution. I remember visiting Wall Street, like I said, probably 10 years ago, and sort of that beginning of that residential neighborhood was there. In the 1960s, or there was a book written about Wall Street saying nobody would ever want to live in downtown New York.
I'm not laughing.
Good luck.
The reason I'm smiling is because I was about to say something that I knew I shouldn't say because
oh,
Marjorie is here.
Say it.
When I lived in New York City, I'm not going to look at you when I say I look at Kara. When
you
I lived in New York City,
prostitutes.
I used to run through Wall Street. And one of the joys of running through Wall Street is you'd be at a place on the weekends where you knew during the weekday you couldn't even move, much less run, where there was not one single solitary person. And then a decade or two later, it's this huge residential.
Right.
Don't say anything, Marjorie.
Want to say anything about the New York City Marathon, Jim?
I happen to have finished a couple, if that's what you're asking. Thank you for asking, Marjorie.
Okay.
Stephanie, you're in JP. You're on with Boston Public Radio with Kara Miller, Jim, and Marjorie. Hi there.
Hi there. How are you?
Excellent.
Great.
Thanks for the call.
Give a call because I'm actually in the process this very day of moving from Jamaica Plain to Hingham.
Why?
So my husband and I, I'm 30 and my husband's 34. We've got a child on the way and I'm just exhausted of the city. I work in the city and I will continue to do so I'll commute, but I'm just exhausted going to the grocery store, just finding parking in the parking lot I drive. I don't take public transportation,
yeah.
But it's just everything is a hassle. It's just driving down Center Street in Jamaica Plain takes 40 minutes.
Well, that's true.
Stephanie, you just destroyed the whole segment, Stephanie. Stephanie, thanks for the call. We appreciate it. What's your reaction to that, Carmela?
I actually think it's a really important point because one of the real questions here, you've got a bunch of people, Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine, Alan Ehrenhalt, who is a big scholar on looking at the future of cities, who all say the same thing. The cities and the suburbs are switching places. We're ending a major era in the suburbs. You see the poor growing in the suburbs for the first time in a really long time. More poor people now live in suburbs than in cities. cities. But I think that the point she brings up is
more
really
important. Poor people live in suburbs than live in cities?
16 million people who are poor in America live in suburbs. 13 million now live in cities.
Well, hold
it has
on.
Switched.
That is, and there's public housing in a lot of suburbs now that didn't used to be there.
Yes, and the suburban poor are growing at 5 times the rate that the urban poor are because people are leaving cities who cannot afford those cities. It's happening in Washington, D.C., all over the place. But I also think it's dangerous to say, hey, millennials are different. They're not like the baby boomers, right? And they're not like Gen X. They're not going to ever want a place for their kids to run around. They're not going to want 25. They'll be fine in their little shoebox houses. I think it's dangerous because, you know, there is something common to people. And I think it's possible that as those people get to be 30 and 35 and 40, and as she said, have a baby on the way, they do want more space and they don't want to be in shoeboxes. I don't know. Some people say millennials fundamentally different. I'm not sure.
Let's go to Art in Worcester. Hi, Art from Worcester.
Hey, Art.
Hi there. Hi there. Well, I don't live in a rural area, but I've always had an urban brain. But I think you're greatly generalizing about this. For example, the qualities of things people experience in a suburb, they ultimately decide not necessarily to move back in unless their kids are grown or whatever, is that they'll move farther out and use subcenters, places like Framingham or others, where they say, okay, I don't have to drive into the city for my work. I'll just, the market will respond and work moves out too. There are these choices. The fact is the economics of cities are making it desirable for in small neighborhoods, only in very small areas, where the wealthy can exist. And then you have the increased values, like the previous caller, where land values are going up and the poor are getting pushed out to the suburbs. And then probably in the future, we'll find that the cities will get worn out and people will be moving out of city, and then the poor will move back in. I mean, this is like a tide going and coming.
Art, we only have to let you go. It was a great point, I think. Carol will respond. The connection is horrible, so we have to cut you off. Thank you. What's your reaction to that, Carol Miller?
Well, you know, clearly, I mean, he makes a very important point, which is you can only have so many people living in cities before the prices are so astronomical, and we're pretty much already there, where you're talking in Boston, in many neighborhoods, a nice place is over $1 million. I mean, that prices out an awful lot of people. But I reject the notion that this is the tide goes in and out, unless you mean the tide goes in and out every 100 years. We are seeing a once in a century shift from the suburbs to the cities. I mean, this is a real change, and I think it's reshaping our politics. We didn't get to talk about that too much, but we're seeing very Democratic people move into cities and the inner suburbs around the cities. I will say the inner suburbs, the places that are very, very close to the cities, very often have the same mindset as the city. You know, you talked about Wellesley and Brooklyn. Well, those are very close-in suburbs.
Right, right.
What are you doing tonight and Saturday, Kara Miller?
Oh, God.
I love this part
of
the thing.
Because I forget everything, too, Kara.
Okay,
I'm with you.
Tonight, we are talking about Amazon and how it wants to take over the world. And Saturday, we are talking about, what are we talking about, Chelsea?
City. Oh, you're doing the city thing on
Saturday.
Oh, yeah,
Saturday. We're talking about cities. What
are you asking
me this for?
Can I tell you something? This is pathetic that you have no idea.
You're trying to stump me?
Yeah, and we stumped you yet again. I think it's 11 straight weeks.
It is
whatever
not.
It is, she's on tonight and she's on Saturday, too. Kara Miller from the Innovation Hub. Thanks, Kara.
Thank you.
Okay, she is on Saturday mornings at 10 o'clock, and tonight she's talking about Jeff Bezos and Ed Rendell. In case you
former mayor
yes,
of Philly
exactly.
and governor
okay.
of Pennsylvania.
Exactly. All right. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow with our Friday news quiz and open mic with Emily Rooney and Emily's List. And in the spirit of You Are Not Alone, Mitch Albom, who writes a lot about aging and mortality, the famous Tuesdays with Maurice, he'll be at Brookline Booksmith tonight at 7:30 to talk about his new book, The First Phone Call from Heaven. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio, Chelsea Merz, Will Roselip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan are on our production team. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Browdy.
Thanks for listening. Talk to you tomorrow.